Welcome to our second session with Dr. Jim Davison. We are on the way to Easter with John's Gospel. Today's topic is the Jews, authorities, and leading citizens. And now Jim will open with prayer.
Morning, everybody. It's good to see you all this morning again on this bright early hour. Slight change in the normal times. So let's open with a word of prayer. Our gracious God, once again this morning and all mornings, as in all mornings, we give you thanks for a new day, for life in your Son, and for the opportunities we have to learn and to share and to grow. Be with us, we pray, in this hour too, and all of this day, that we might be drawn closer to you. We thank you for your Son. Thank you for this Lenten period that we are remembering him and what he did on our behalf. And we pray that all that we do might be in his name, through Christ. Amen. Well, it's good to see you all this morning, actually. Well, I wondered. I mean, it's easy to, for this, although now that the clocks are electronic, a lot of them automatically change, so that helps. Then, but you only have to remember then, do I need to get up at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock? Will it have changed? And so I did. I mean, it all had worked out, and I knew that was fine. So I left the clocks at the house on the wall where they are. Thought I'll change them later, and so they agreed. I got 3/4 of the way here, and I was not expecting my car phone to have changed. Am I late? But it wasn't. It had just done its little electronic thing now too. So I'd forgotten. It did that last year, but I did not remember that. The things you worry about, right? Anyway, last time. If we can move to that first slide, or the next slide, rather. Last time, for those of you who were not here last week, we talked about John, a spiritual gospel. Basically, an introduction to the gospel, and trying to point out some of the things about it that are different from the other gospels, and particularly the difference in terms of John's goal to let us know who Christ is, to talk about the meaning of Christ, not really a historical walkthrough, as the other Gospels do, of his life in the order necessarily in which it happened. And then there's therefore long discourses where Jesus is speaking with or to a person or a group and spends that time, again, developing the meaning of what faith is all about, what God is like, and so forth and so on. And therefore, this book has been known for centuries as a spiritual gospel, which is why I put that as the theme. But also then, John has been known for centuries in terms of what kind of writer was he as a gospel writer, as the theologian. That goes way back in church history. It's on icons on a regular basis in the Orthodox tradition. And so the little icon up there in the corner, if you can't see it very well from here at this point, but that that would be the left-hand side for me, the right-hand side for you. Yes, is it says under there in smaller print, the theologian. But it gives you a sense of who he is. And now what I want to do today and the next 2 weeks is talk about people right around the time of the crucifixion and then resurrection. So incidents there, and do those by the kind of people who were involved. And today then, as you see, we're going to be talking about the Jews. Jewish authorities and the leading citizens. That's the primary theme. And as a result, we'll be mentioning Pilate along the way, just by name almost. Next week, I'll focus more on him. So we'll kind of jump through some of the passages. And there is a handout, right? We could pass that out now, actually. That would be good. I didn't think of that to mention that in advance, unfortunately. My fault. Oops, here comes the solution. Wow. It's really something when they're listening into you, isn't it? It's even more effective than a Siri. Thanks, Sarah. While we're passing that out, I can actually ask you a basic question to start, to get a sense for what's going on. I mean, you could put that up there, Ted, the next slide. And that would be simply a general question. What comes to mind for you, or what do you remember, perhaps, about the Sadducees from Jesus' time? Anybody want to take a run at that? The Sadducees. You may know that they go with the Pharisees, but they don't go very well with the Pharisees. There's usually disagreements between the groups. Anybody? You got that?
Yeah.
You get 5 stars. Yes, there you go, Sandy. Yeah, that's the Sadducees originally come from way back. I mean, it developed into this group called the Sadducees. But way back at the earliest times of Israel, they have a high priest. Well, they have a whole priesthood, but then there's one who's the high priest. And that person is in charge of the temple. That person is not particularly significant otherwise. In other words, no power to speak of, simply operative in the temple, tabernacle, then the temple. But over time, as the temple structure became bigger, as more and more sorts of things were happening there, just kind of like big government, the result was that there was a whole group of folks who gradually became richer to start with, but they also ended up with more elevated positions, and they became ultimately an aristocracy. They were the aristocrats of the time. And the high priest then was the most significant of them. But until shortly before Jesus' day, the high priest was just the high priest. He wasn't anything. He had no political function. But that changes because this, as Israel gets taken over by the Babylonians and then is ruled by others along the way for another 300-400 years before the Romans arrive, the aristocracy becomes more and more significant. They become the ones who deal with the governing authorities. When the Romans come, the Romans then put they take the high priesthood and they give a certain person that title from the priesthood. It's no longer what it had originally been, passed down from father to son to son to son and so forth, as it had been for years. It now becomes an office that you can want to get. And therefore, if that happened, yes, Debbie. That's the next thing. Yes. Good point. There, see, it's coming back to you. yeah, they as they become more powerful, then the high priest becomes more powerful. But this group as a whole, Sadducees, are a very conservative group. They want to maintain the status quo. They want to protect the country from being destroyed, partly because, well, what would happen to all their wealth, all their importance and significance if Rome were to end up wiping out a lot of what was going on due to some rebellion or other. So they're always trying to keep the people under thumb. And they're also then, because they are a conservative group, they want to say, you know, actually, the only true scripture is the Torah, the five books of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy. All the rest of it, they came later. That doesn't count. Besides which, the prophets, of course, were troublemakers, right? They were not keeping the status quo. They were saying things are wrong. We need to change them. As a result, the Sadducees say, no, we stay with the five books of Moses. And then there's, to your point, Debbie, you don't find resurrection in the five books of Moses. That comes much later, even the thought of it. You don't find a list of things, actually. Resurrection of the dead, no afterlife of any sort beyond that concept called Sheol. No spirit realm in any sense, and no angels, among other things. So it's very down-to-earth kind of religion that they hold. The Pharisees hold to all of those things, which is why the debates between the two become really strong. So if you worked well with the Romans then as the high priest, you might stay in that position a while, right? That's the background for the fact that they did their best to try to hold things under wraps, because they knew what would happen if ever it were the case that a rebellion took place. They could lose everything, the Sadducees. Well, guess what happened? In 70 AD, roughly 40 years after Jesus' life on earth, there is a rebellion. There's a huge war. Eventually, Jerusalem itself is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. And the Sadducees disappear from the pages of history. The group that remains is the other group, the Pharisees, because the Pharisees then were actually teachers as well. They're the ones who are called rabbi, and they are the ones who become the rabbinic group within Judaism and rebuild the nation. The Romans then have them rebuild it. But of course, by that point, there's no way they can be revolting. And they simply start to close in with laws and make it all that they already believe as tight as they can to hold their nation together. And so from then on, we get what's called the rabbis. The Mishnah and all these kinds of things come from them. That's the background, really, for what we're looking at today, initially especially. And so on that sheet that you have, we can move to the first paragraph that I've distinguished in there. And if we could put that on the slide. Notice what it says. So the soldiers, their officer, and the Jewish police arrested Jesus, and they bound him. First, they took him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest, that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was better to have one person die for the people. And there I've dropped out some things that we don't really need to talk about at the moment before the next part. But this part, notice what is said. We know from Josephus, a Jewish historian from this time period, that Annas had five sons. Eventually, all five of them served 1 year each as the high priest, as it turns out. But Annas served about 9 years. And Caiaphas ended up married to at least one daughter that Annas had. Caiaphas, after about a three-year difference in Annas going no longer being high priest, Caiaphas then rules 18 years straight. But Annas is with him in the background and still has a lot of respect or significance. And as a result, actually, when you read Luke chapter 3, when Luke is busily telling us the setting, he mentions that this was during the priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, as though they're both, you know, high priests same time, which is not the case. But both then can be called high priests, just like we consider the person who has been president or a senator or some other things. They are called that after they leave office. Same is happening with Annas here. So Annas is the first one that that sees Jesus, actually, in this case. And then we're told that Caiaphas was the one who advised, as I just read that. There's a story behind that, which, of course, is earlier in John. If you remember, when Lazarus is resurrected by Jesus, it brings all sorts of news and excitement. And word gets back to the council, the Sanhedrin, in Jerusalem, not far away, that this has happened. So do they rejoice? What do you think? No. What's going on here? This could be dangerous. And at least as it's written in John, and I didn't put this on a slide, what are we to do? This man is performing many signs. If we let him go like this, everyone will believe in him. They don't believe in him. They don't want anybody else to. He's a prophet, that type of person. So he's a danger. But it's ironic, isn't it? This amazing wonder, the most amazing one we read of in the Bible, apart from Jesus' own resurrection. They hear about it and they say, how do we get rid of this guy? We don't want any more of that to happen. We don't want anybody healed, much less raised from the dead. They put Jesus in the category of rebels, threats to the nation, and that's where it stands. I'm sorry?
He was kind of like a terrorist.
Pretty close, at least potentially.
Could you repeat that for the people online?
Oh yeah, sure. He was a...
Well, it was just dawning on me that he was, to them, like a terrorist is to us.
Yeah.
He didn't use weapons, but he used words that, to them, were very serious weapons, right?
That's right. Yeah, and there were a number of revolutionaries around who got movements going and did actually rebel. Small scale, they didn't last long. They got wiped out pretty quickly, each of them, but you never know. This one might be a bigger one. So in any case, Caiaphas, and that's a setting, when he hears that in the Sanhedrin, and I do have a slide for that. But Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said, you know nothing at all. How do you like that for a pretty straight statement? He'd been high priest for a while by then. Oh, and I didn't say, he'd been high priest probably for about 8 to 10 years of the 18 by the time Jesus came on, came before him. So he was in office. He knew how things worked. He had it all flowing nicely, right? You know nothing at all. You do not understand that it is better for you to have one man die for the people than to have the whole nation destroyed. Makes some sense from his perspective, doesn't it? And we see, you'll see movies occasionally, particularly war movies, where somebody runs out to save the rest of the group, knowing that that person's going to get killed. We consider that person a hero. In the movie, at least. And Caiaphas was thinking in those same terms, but it's somebody else that's running out there and giving themselves. And the end result is just to get rid of the person. So he does not consider Jesus, would not have considered Jesus, obviously, a hero at all. But one other thing to note in that is one person died for the nation. How is John, the writer, thinking about that? Better for one man to die for the people than the whole nation to be destroyed. What about it's better to for one person to die? Oh, sorry. Yes.
Is he foreshadowing Jesus' death?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, it's foreshadowing Jesus' death. Jesus will do this, and John will say this as well, that he does it for not just the nation, but for the whole world, John says in that context. So it's a foreshadowing, actually, the whole of salvation, and certainly of the cross and resurrection. And that's the one more time, you know, last time I was talking about there's two levels oftentimes here. Something is said on one level, but there's a deeper, more profound level at which it could be understood. And John is trying to hint at that without actually oftentimes saying it. Sometimes he says it directly. And here, actually, he does. So then the rest of this this paragraph, or most of it, if we look at that now, you'll see, then we read, then the high priest Annas questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me. They know what I said. Get witnesses, in other words. If you want to accuse me of something, don't you have some witnesses? What do I need to say what it is that I've been doing? You know, it's an interesting response. And as a result, he gets struck, you see, from the next little bit there. He's struck by one of the officials who's standing there saying, how do you dare talk to the high priest that way? To which he said, Jesus says, if what I say is right, why do you strike me? In other words, Jesus does not take it back. He does not apologize. Oh, the high priest. No. He's a good deal higher than the high priest, ultimately. So he does not do that. But that's another example, actually, of the way Jesus takes charge, which I mentioned last time, and we're going to keep seeing that through these events. Something is going on. Something happens. Jesus now is in the trial. You would think he's a victim. At anything they want to do, they can do to him. But what happens? He says he does something that is different. It means that he's not simply going along with whatever they want. He's still the one who ultimately is in charge of all of this. We'll see that again shortly, actually. So then, excuse me, he says, I have spoken openly, and so forth. And from there, we can go on to the next paragraph. I'm not going to read that whole one. It's kind of lengthy. But I don't really want to talk about Pilate, as I said. So what I'm going to do is kind of mention, and you can follow there if you want, but do have a slide to go with that. Or two of them, actually, to see the progress of how the high priest and the Sanhedrin, or the Sadducees, how they developed their argument to get rid of Jesus. So notice the first one. Pilate says to them, behold the man, that famous phrase that you've heard many times, I'm sure. The chief priests and the police shouted, crucify him, crucify him. Straightforward. This is what we want. And Pilate then goes on to say, well, take him yourselves. You know, why bother me? And then he says, I find no case against him. The Jews answered, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he claims to be the Son of God. Well, that's a religious claim. Technically, it's not political. But it's bound to make Pilate a little nervous. And we'll talk more about that next week, actually. Just because Caesar called himself son of the gods. But that leaves him up in the air, Pilate. And so he talks to Jesus again in the next slide. For the third thing that happens then, Pilate comes back out and once again wants to release him. So Pilate is actually trying him. But they say to him, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. no friend to Caesar. Everyone who claims to be a king sets himself against Caesar. So now we get the political, the pure political statement and charge. Oops, you could be disloyal if you don't deal with this Jesus. So one more time, actually, Pilate talks to Jesus. But then he comes back out and he says, well, what do you want me to do? Shall I crucify your king? He kind of sticks it in a little bit to them. And the chief priests answer, we have no king but Caesar. Think about that. Remember, as I was starting to mention, the Sadducees, their belief is that the king is, or rather the Torah is the rule. Where is the king mentioned, or a king mentioned in the Torah? Never appears. There is no king. Right? This occurs, 1 Samuel and so forth, when the people want a king, and so God kind of reluctantly allows them to have one and says, watch out. But the king, the original intent was for Israel to be ruled by God and God alone. That was the original intent. So that's in the Torah. And now the Sadducees say, we have no king but Caesar. They've now denied not just that Jesus could be anything special, but they've actually denied God, the God that they claim to be worshiping. They have fallen very far away. They're trapped, really, by their views and their need to protect themselves. So they can't really imagine that that anything else could be more significant. And you can let God go to protect yourself. And they do. Well, this would be a good place to mention one other thing, actually, in John's gospel when we look at it. So the next slide is really not different. We've seen it, but I have a different question for you. There's one other issue related to all of this. And the question then would be, who rejects Jesus here? Who actually does John say is rejecting Jesus? The Jews, okay? Any... Yeah, well, I want to stay with the Jewish side of this. Pilate will be next week. But it says the Jews, but it says something else too. I have to read a little further down through there. Okay. Yeah, just above that.
Chief priests.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. The chief priests. So notice... it says the Jews, then it says the chief priests. This happens all through John. Oftentimes, John talks about Jesus speaking with the Jews and in debate and issues then with what they believe and how they're acting. But oftentimes, and more often, or well, I shouldn't say it's more often, but more technically, it is the chief priests or the Jewish officials or the high priest. And that kind of language. And the point I want to make is it does occur all through the Bible that you read the Jews on their own, I mean, that language, but that's short for the leaders of the Jews, the authorities. And I want to stress that because for 50, 60, maybe longer years, it's become common for popular writers, but also some biblical scholars to talk about the Gospel of John as being anti-Judaic or anti-Semitic because of that kind of language. And now remember in Matthew at the trials too, in chapter 27, the Jews say, his blood be on us and our children, which is a frightening statement to have made. But it's led once again to people saying, well, these gospels are anti-Semitic. There's no question that the way Christians have acted on the basis of all of this, all through history, is pretty despicable. I mean, awful. So all through the Middle Ages, the Jews were treated as scapegoats, and they ended up fleeing from one country to another as they were persecuted, sometimes eventually back to the country they came from originally, at least. It's kind of like a circular motion at times. And other times, they fled to Muslim lands, where they often were treated better than the Christian lands were treating them. But often the Muslims have persecuted them as well. And they become the persecuted group, the scapegoats for pretty much everybody, as we know. And unfortunately, that, of course, has continued right up to today. With we had in Squirrel Hill a shooting in a synagogue. And the person probably, I don't remember this exactly, but it was connected to Christianity in some manner or other. But that's been typical for years and years and years. What I want to say is, on the one hand, I don't think it's fair to call the biblical books anti-Semitic. And one good reason would simply be they were written by Jewish people. That's the background, you know. It's a debate between them. It's none of them are saying the nation is bad in that manner. But the other side of it is extremely tragic that this kind of thing has been happening and continues to happen, and we don't seem to be able to eradicate it. It just is a tragic sort of thing, and it's tragic that it has come out of a misreading of the scriptures, that it's happened. But it's then, therefore, also a good reminder, I think, of how misleading it can be to think and to speak in terms of broad either or kind of categories. When we start to say it's this or that, it's either this or that, and that kind of language without any nuance about what you're talking about, it's very easy for that to turn into this is good, that is evil. They are good, they are evil. And then the attacks come on whatever that group might be, whether Jewish or others. Either ors, in other words, are almost automatically dangerous unless you put some kind of parameters around them as you speak. Isn't that what's happening in our political discourse continually? There's no middle ground currently, or at least not many who get much notice. And it's become dangerous for the whole country and for the lives of individual people of various sorts, even the politicians themselves. So we have to also be aware, in addition to saying the Gospels are not anti-Semitic, we've also got to be aware, in other words, that the way they were written turned out to have some terrible consequences. And those we can't forget. Let me stop for a second. Any questions or thoughts?
The distinction between Jews and were there anybody that called themselves Christians at that point? So when you say something I've always struggled with is how did they, you didn't have mass media back then. How did people change their views so quickly? You always have the impression it's all the crowds are saying crucify them. Is that not right? It was just the leaders saying that, or did they turn that entire, you know, all the populace to being against Christ at that point? Were there Christians out there, people that are following Christ that didn't agree with us?
Yeah, at that point, there weren't any Christians directly. There were disciples of Jesus, but it wasn't really a separate faith or understood as such. They just, and this really lasted for a long time, that As far as, if you look at, I'll say, I'm going to back up and say it slightly differently. The Sadducees disappear, right, in the end of the first century. Two groups, Jewish groups, survive because the Zealots, which I haven't talked about, the Essenes and all of those folks, they're gone too. But there's two groups. We know the Pharisees become the rabbis. They continue, and that's what has become Judaism as we know it today. The other group that survives is the Christians. I mean, that flows out of that, and that is originally, obviously, a Jewish movement, but a Jewish movement that opens up to Gentiles being part of it. And as they go out into the rest of the world and start making conversions, it's not long before there's more Gentiles than there are Jews. So it starts to look like they are different, but it's the same root. They're really, we are really part of the Jewish tradition as Christians. And it's so easy to forget that. And maybe if we remembered that better, and that Jesus was Jewish after all, it might help with some of the back and forth in regard to what Judaism is like.
This happened over purportedly 2 or 3 days. Was there that mass turning against Jesus, or was it just the Christian or the Jewish leaders that were leading that? The impression it was all the Jews were on board with this.
Yeah, I think actually it's probably a kind of a mix of that, because on Palm Sunday you have quite a few people who seem to be coming in saying, "Hail to the Messiah." But they get turned around. It's kind of like the leaders knew how to work that for their advantage, because if they go out and start saying certain things, then the people pick it up, and they can say it in ways to get the people to pick it up. Again, not very different from what happens these days.
Right. Hang on.
Wasn't it kind of like crowd hysteria?
That'd be a good way to describe it. Yeah, some of the events occur inside, so we know it's only the leaders, you know, where Pilate is talking with them. But then Pilate is out in the open for the ultimate thing, and you have the leaders all saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." What are the people going to say? The ones who don't like it are going to disappear. But they're not going to be disagreeing. I mean, you don't do that with the aristocracy. Yes.
I think it's significant that, you know, the Jewish leaders had all this to say about, you know, what Christ was doing and things, but nobody from just the common people, where he had traveled around and given his messages and done miracles and all this, and nobody stood up and defended him. Yeah, you know, do we have that kind of thing today? No.
Yes, well, that's correct. I mean, you know. Yeah, they don't. I mean, in some ways, there's no forum for them to defend him, because it's all done. The actual trial stuff mostly is behind closed doors until they bring him out and say, "Here's your king. What do you think?" And they get the crowd to say, "We want Barabbas." That's in John as well. I'm just not mentioning it. I wasn't mentioning it particularly.
There was a quote this week that seems to apply a little bit to this that we're discussing, and that was about the labor demonstrations in France, and they're contrasting that with the recent election in France, where Macron ran on the idea that he was going to make these changes to pensions that they're all upset about now. And someone asked, "Well, you know, how do you reconcile, how do you square that?" And the person made a good observation, which is, well, you have elections and then you have the street, and those are often different.
Oh, okay.
Especially in France, they were saying.
Could be true here too. Yeah.
Anybody online with any questions or comments? Feel free to unmute and speak up.
One more and then we'll keep moving.
Yeah, you're kind of describing with the leadership an authoritarian style of leadership, right?
Yeah. Yeah, ultimately the way it's been through most of history, yeah, in most countries, and still is mostly today.
That's why democracy is special.
Yeah, and so difficult to keep. Yep. So anyway, I said we need to watch black and white, right? And the either ors. So now I've been talking about the Jewish leaders, and the Sanhedrin being the ones who were out, more than the people as a whole, intentionally at least, the Sanhedrin being the ones who wanted to make sure that they were able to get rid of Jesus. So then I've just said they have been doing this. That's what they were like. But wait a minute, there's a little more to that story too, right? Is it an either or? Were there any people perhaps in the Sanhedrin who disagreed? I'm sorry? Nicodemus? Let's turn to the other side of your sheet.
Sandy said about Nicodemus, and I said, I thought Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and aren't these all Sadducees that are doing this?
I didn't say that clearly enough. There are Pharisees on the council as well. It's just the Sadducees rule it. So there are normally leading Pharisees would be part of the council. Yeah, it's a complicated situation. I don't know how they made it work at all. You know, we have our folks sit on opposite sides so they don't hurt each other, you know, in the Congress. I don't know what they did. You know, maybe they were in different rooms. there were some who were not opposed, and it might have been more than we know about, of course. So notice the next paragraph. The next slide, please. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, though a secret one because of his fear of the Jews, asked Pilate to let him take away the body of Jesus. Pilate gave him permission, so he came and removed the body. As you read this whole paragraph, which we'll come back to the rest of it, it really kind of strikes me that when you read chapter 19 and so forth and get through the crucifixion and all the trial material and then the actual crucifixion and then so forth, you know, that's awful. This has a peaceful feel to it and sound. It's almost like a calm after it's all over, you know, just everything settles down. And doesn't mean it's settled down because it's good, but it just the atmosphere, it feels like there's some grace going on in the midst of all of this, even. And in this case, it is Joseph, the secret disciple, we're told, who fears the Jews, he's really afraid of the leaders, right? He doesn't really want to be kicked out of the Sanhedrin. Or thought too badly of, or whatever. We don't know anymore. It's interesting, though, that Joseph is mentioned in all four Gospels. And so he's a clearly distinguishable figure there. We don't know anything more about him, actually, than this. There's no more history. Did he then become an open disciple at some point? Did he end up in mission work or not? He could have been older. He could have died in the next 2 years. I mean, there's just no information about him. That will leave the church opportunities in later times, as they like to make nice pieces of further information and stories to do some things with him. But none of those have any basis in, you know, what we know originally. Yes, do you have a question or a comment?
Yeah. Can we assume that Joseph was Jewish?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And if we're talking about the leadership when we say the Jews, why don't we clarify that in the writing so that it doesn't seem like the Jewish population per se? You know, It well, really changes things when you see the Jewish leadership, or, you know, however you want to phrase it, when you read this, and we do make modifications to scripture, like, wouldn't this be a good one for interpretation purposes? Yeah, it's thrown out there.
Well, I'm just thinking translators are not going to be happy with that idea. Yeah. Because it's not the word that's there. but I see your point. I mean, yeah, we do make some very minor changes, although they're getting to be more major as time goes on sometimes. But in any case, that would be helpful. I know that most texts, when you read something, they will tell you, I mean, the commentaries will say that up front as some of their discussion. But of course, you don't get that just hearing it read, or as it normally would be printed in the bulletin or something like that. Joseph, though, was definitely, he would not have been in the Sanhedrin if he had not been Jewish. That's the starting point. But then the other interesting thing, well, I'll come back to that because I want to mention Nicodemus here first. But interestingly, last week, if you were here at either of the services, Nicodemus was the theme, and an intro to John that was wonderful. You know, yes. I'm sorry? Had no idea. No idea at all. Didn't coordinate, yeah. But in any case, Nicodemus is one person that we know, right? And she mentioned him last week too, where at the beginning, we are told that he comes to Jesus. Yeah, there's a slide you could throw up there, please, Ted. In chapter 3. So this is right at the beginning of the book, basically, right? One of the first things. And the first major conversation or dialogue that Jesus has. Now there was a Pharisee named Nicodemus, a leader of the Jews. He came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God." Nice way to start, you know, make the person feel acceptable. And that's going to go a long way with Jesus. "For no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with that person." Correct. Jesus answered him, not at all with what he said, but truly, depending on your translation, "I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born from above." Doesn't exactly fit, right, with what the nice way Nicodemus was trying to get into this. But notice a couple things. We're told that Nicodemus comes at night. What's that mean?
He wants a secret.
He wants to keep it secret. Yeah, he wants to keep it secret. Because he doesn't want people knowing what he's doing. He also wants a private conversation when there's not a crowd around. He wants to actually sit down with him face to face. But wait a minute. Could there be a more profound level to this one too? Comes to him at night. Yeah, we can't read through the rest of John 3, but do that at home this afternoon. And you'll find what is said later in this discussion, near the end of it, actually, is about light and dark, and people who are in the dark or in the light, and whether those whose hearts are good will come to the light. Those whose hearts would prefer the dark. John is telling us he's coming out of not knowing towards faith. Doesn't say he's gotten there, but he's interested. Okay? So there's one. And then the other one, of course, is you need to be born again there, or born from above, as that translation puts it. And again, as I've said a number of times now, that's the more likely translation, because that's the way the word is usually used. In any case, after that, Nicodemus appears in the gospel again in chapter 7. This is when there's a festival going on. Jesus is speaking in the courtyard, and the council then hears about it, and they send the police, their police, to come out and get them, arrest them, and bring them back. So this is chapter 7. This is a long way before the end of the gospel. And so then we read in that next slide. I forgot to say that the council or the police explained what has happened. They didn't bring them back by saying, nobody ever spoke like this. They're taken aback. They don't know what to do. So they don't arrest him. And the council says, are you deceived? Talking to them. None of the authorities believe in him. The crowds don't know what they're talking about. They're accursed anyway. See, they have a pretty low view of their own people. And then Nicodemus stands up at this point, or however they did that in that setting at the time, and says, our law does not judge people without first giving them a hearing to find out what they're doing, does it? Let's do this right. Let's talk to him if we got a problem. They replied, surely you're not also from Galilee, are you? Search and you will see. No prophet is to arise from Galilee. Well, you're going to be searching a long while to find that statement in the scriptures. Particularly in that they don't believe in prophets. And they didn't talk about Galilee as a district in the Torah. Not there. But they use that. That's, again, can anything good come out of Nazareth, as we said last week? So they put down Nicodemus simply by saying, are you one of them? Which reminded me of the possibility that we might sometimes ourselves use phrases like that. Oh, he's from, she's from, pick your favorite state. to come down on or whatever. But it's so typical to do that, to answer a question by that sort of thing. Anyway, from there, we moved now to Nicodemus in the current sheet that you have in front of you, where we come back to the tomb. Nicodemus appears for that. Ted, can you? There you go. Came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes. Now there was a garden in the place where he was crucified, nearby. And in that garden, there was a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. So it's a new tomb, unused, and clearly, from everything we know, hewn out of the rock. That's the kind of tomb that you bury the aristocracy and also the rich in general. The well-off folks would cut these things out of the rock, sometimes for whole families. So you see niches and some of the, you know, pictures of things like that. Poorer folks would be buried in the ground, nothing else around them. And criminals, like people who've been on the cross, criminals would usually be thrown into a common pit and left to rot. Although sometimes I guess their families were allowed to come and get the remains if they wanted to. Matthew tells us that this is Joseph's own tomb. And that would make some sense. It's kind of speculative as to why and how that worked. But if he was from Arimathea, which sounds like, but he probably now is in Jerusalem and staying there, more or less has moved there, he may already have bought a location to build a tomb for himself and his family. And if that's the case, then it could very easily be new and unused and ready to go, so to speak. That makes sense. You can't be sure that that's exactly what happened. But in any case, we don't really know why Joseph and Nicodemus did what they did in general. They clearly had respect for Jesus. We are told that Joseph was a disciple. How strictly that meant disciple is uncertain. Sometimes the word is used really tightly, to mean somebody who's, you know, full scale dedicated. Sometimes it's more loosely paying attention and learning, which is really what the word means, and thinking about it. But in any case, they do have a tremendous amount of respect for Jesus to do this. They are taking a risk, and the risk really is that the Sanhedrin will disdain them for what they've done. One other thing about this, though, is if you go to the next slide, Ted, it's a little fuller. Nicodemus came bringing a mixture of the myrrh and aloes, weighing about 100 pounds. They took the body of Jesus, wrapped it in spices with the linen cloths. That's the way the burials normally were done, as the rest of it says there. And that's a tremendous amount of spicing. And that apparently is about 75 pounds in American pounds. That would take a couple of people to carry it. So in other words, these are the leaders in doing this, but they have help to move the body and to bury him. But does anybody, does anything seem out of joint to you about the statement of they're putting the spices on Jesus in such a large, not so much the large amount, but the spices? What were the women doing on Sunday morning when they came early, according to Matthew, the other Gospels? Sandy?
They were bringing spices to prepare the body. But if he already had them.
Yeah. Yeah, the other Gospels tell us that, this was late when Jesus was taken down from the cross. He's put in the tomb. He's supposed to be buried in advance so that the Sabbath will not be disturbed, in a sense. And so the spices, the women come in the early morning, Sunday, after the rest day, in order to, or the Sabbath, in order to do the usual kind of spices. But here, John has it happening right away. I think this is at least the best way I can describe this, is that this is another case where John adjusts events a little bit. He's not really concerned with the exact history of it. You've got the other three Gospels. You can learn it from them. What he's concerned with is getting through to the story with Mary Magdalene right away, and he doesn't want to spend time then. He wants to move right into her and her meeting Jesus. And so he also secondarily wants to mention again, as I said, all those spices. 75 pounds in our number, that's a huge number. There's a report in the Mishnah, at least I think it's the Mishnah, but it's one of the rabbinical writings that talks about Gamaliel, the famous Jewish rabbi, who actually appears in Acts, and Paul says he trained under Gamaliel, very well known, one of the real superstars of the rabbis. And there was a certain man named Onkelos, not otherwise known, but he burned 60 pounds of spices in Gamaliel's honor when he died. Why? Because he was far better than 100 kings. It's kind of like all the spices, a new tomb, all of this together is to say, this is the king of the Jews that you've just put in the tomb. And that's what he wants to get at. And he can say it by means of adding the spices right at this stage as well. Well, the final slide, please, Ted, because we're running out of time, I know. I want to leave you with a question for thought, which is simply, what if chapter 19 was the end of the story? The burial. The high priests and the leaders, they think they got what they wanted, right? Jesus is dead. Pilate has done what they want him to do. He's now in a tomb. He won't disrupt anything ever again, so they think. But the same would be true for Nicodemus, right, and Joseph, and all those who might have been there helping with the actual burial. They've laid Jesus to rest. He's now gone. And the grief and the shock are all over them. But no expectation of anything further. We know, of course, that there is more to the story. But the problem with that is we then don't, in a sense, feel what they felt at that point. So what I want to suggest to you, in other words, is when Good Friday comes around and you read these stories, hear these stories, and so forth, try to think back to Joseph and Nicodemus and how they felt at that point, with no hope, no expectation of anything beyond it, except the loss of their hero. Yeah. Yeah, just look at that Rembrandt picture. and try to think of that so that when Easter comes, instead of already on Friday thinking about what you're going to wear or what the dinner is going to be or who knows what, or where are you going out to lunch maybe, so that the shock, the good shock of what Easter is all about reaches down into your soul and mine. So that's my goal for you. And we're out of time. So blessings to you all and see you next week. Thanks.